Well, tonight we return to our subject of a few weeks back, to addresses that I've given on the question of Christian living in a godless age, Britain 2013. We're looking at restraints and the restraints God has been pleased to give in his mercy to nations in general, and perhaps our own in particular, the presence of an evangelical church, for instance, being one of those chief restraints upon the onward march of evil. We saw last time the issue of culture, and consider that as best we could. It's a massive subject, but one in which we can see that as culture describes fundamental beliefs, attitudes, ambitions of any given society, that those attitudes, those kinds of views as to what is good, right, proper, have moved against the Christian faith. Well, tonight, we're going to look at some specific issues that have affected our nation and our society. Trends and developments which have, for the most part, been unhelpful. This is where I'm going to be controversial, and we're going to be looking at some politics. We're going to at least look at some political developments which I think have had a profound effect on the nature of the state, or government if you will, and left us exposed to some of the problems that we are now facing in Britain 2013. So we're going to consider some of these. It's not as if what I'm going to talk about tonight is the only factor. There have been other factors too that have been important, shaping the country that we now are and the kind of culture that is underpinning the mainstream view that is held. We looked and there was a fair amount of diversity. The more we look at culture, the less clear it becomes in effect. But if we can allow ourselves still this idea that there is a mainstream culture, and by and large that mainstream culture has less and less time for the Christian faith. But first of all, we must pause to catch up, albeit briefly, with our pilgrim as we endure the next instalment of Pilgrim's Regress. Our friend has now set out boldly on his chosen course, imagining himself to be helped along by his burden. Alas, he is making slow progress along route. Then, further along his way, he sees another traveller and catches up with him to talk with him. "Oh, are you a free thinker like me?" he asked. "Oh, yes," his newfound travelling companion answered. "My name is Progressive Thinker." "That's a bit of a mouthful," the pilgrim replied. "Not really," his colleague contradicted him. "It's much shorter than my real name." "What is that?" the pilgrim asked inquiringly. "Well, it is progressive, multiculturalist, new atheist, secularist, post-enlightenment, neo-postmodernist, humanist, neo-Darwinian, anti-foundationalist, religious textist, Gramscian, third-wave feminist, sunny and bright thinker, if you must know." "I see what you mean about the shorter name," conceded the pilgrim. So he tried a different tack. "Well, what actually do you do?" "Oh, I help people think rightly about the important issues of life," he answered rather breezily. "I liberate them from false notions by warning that those things they are thinking are intolerable and must be changed." "How do you know you are right?" Pilgrim asked, thinking that this was a perfectly reasonable question to ask. "I just know," came back the answer. "It's so self-evident. No right-thinking person would ever think otherwise," he said in lofty tones. "It all sounds a bit against free thinking to me," answered the pilgrim warily. "Are we meant to go where the evidence takes us? How can we say that we are all for free thinking if we do not allow people to think freely in the first place? It sounds a bit intolerant, if you know what I mean." Progressive thinker looked at him with some suspicion. "I can see that you still have a little way to go. You need to think a little more progressively. Look, I have something you need." Pilgrim watched as he produced a heavy-looking weight. "Let's put this in your backpack. It will help you make better progress and think straight." The weight was marked the God Delusion. It was a dense weight, packed with wild exaggerations, outrageous claims, poorly digested information, gross misunderstandings, false accusations, topped with a massively inflated ego. "How can this help me?" asked the pilgrim incredulously. progressive thinker was quite unfazed. Everyone who has taken this has been able to regress much faster. You'll see. In a twinkle of an eye, progressive thinker had put the weight in Pilgrim's backpack. The Pilgrim looked dubious at all this as he tottered again as his burden was added to. He tried to get comfortable and to readjust to this unexpected addition and resumed his journey to the sunny uplands, which still, it had to be admitted, looked pretty dark and foreboding from this distance. But there it was. Progressive thinker did seem to know about these things, so on he continued, gaining some momentum as he went. Well, we leave him there. My next heading. A few introductory thoughts. A few introductory thoughts. Well, the person that Pilgrim met there, progressive thinker, we'll need to look out a little further as we go along. But remember the psalm, Psalm 83, that was read a moment ago. Going beyond the names of the nations, see nevertheless how many different groupings are making common cause against the Church of Jesus Christ. They want to cut us off from being a nation, in verse 4, in the hope that we will be remembered no more. There they are, from Amalek, Hagrites, Moabites, Assyria joining with them as well. People who at times may not seem to have really much in common, but who do have something in common in that they all gang up against the church. There they are, they seeing the pastures of God and eyeing them up for a possession for themselves, as in verse 12. And they seem to want to take credit for everything that the Lord has given to the nations in terms of creativity, reason, science, knowledge, truth, compassion, and true liberty. These nations, these opponents of God, seemingly want to claim all these for themselves and be regarded as the real and legitimate claimants to these titles, to have the pastures of God. As I say, even movements that appear to be contradictory. Assyria and Edom and Amalek can find an alliance against the Church of Jesus Christ. Satraps and governors in ancient Persia set themselves against Daniel. Esther and the Lord's people of her time found themselves under threat under a later Persian king, Ahasuerus. And there they found again their whole nation, there threatened with annihilation. So let us look at some perhaps less well-advertised Hagrites and Moabites. You are having perhaps a profound influence on the political process and help us understand maybe why government is so hostile to us now. How has the state become so much part of the culture war against the church militant, both here and in the United States? Why has the state so much abandoned its work of restraining sin? Why has it ended up actively promoting it? So whether we've been aware of it or not, and I think many of us have been aware of it, a number of unhelpful ideas and movements have brought their full weight against the church and against Christians in general. Everything that affects where we are has a history. That's self-evident. It has people, writers, speakers, and the like, who have put forward ideas that have been influential. There are books, events, what look like quite unconnected and distant happenings, that nevertheless have helped make the Britain of 2013 that we are working in. Some of it may be a bit unfamiliar territory to us, but not much more familiar where the day of work, the world of politics and political actors come into focus, and I believe play an important part. Whether we want to admit it or not, rulers, men or women, their advisors and gurus played a huge role in shaping the course of history, for better or for worse. It is the same whether it be dictatorships or democracies. The wars they fight, the wars they do not fight, the things they have a passion about and the things they do not have a passion about, influence the world we are now in. They are not, of course, creatures with no history themselves. They have read books. They have been brought up in families. They have maybe attended churches themselves. They've gone to schools and colleges. They have taken on causes in their youth. They have lived through political and historical events that have made them the men and women that they are. They have married or not married, had lovers, absorbed culture, sometimes, like the rest of us, without knowing it. They have thought about how they would like to change the world and taken steps towards that end in their younger days and on to where we are now. As Christians, we have been happy perhaps to let them get on with this and preferred not to get involved in politics, and this has been very wise in so many ways. We have the gospel to preach. That is our priority. Those of us who do preach, we perhaps need to think about the people we preach to more, as they may well be the kinds of people that we're thinking about in our consideration this evening. Whether we preach to them face to face or have some communication with them through the internet, it's worth knowing a little bit perhaps about their background as best we can ascertain it. They may be the people that we work alongside or with whom we have to spend our time. Though we do not need to know all the details, it may be of help at times to develop some of these themes, like who these people are, and get familiar at least with the outline. For who knows whom we might meet? In a way, we're paying them a compliment, because these people are thinking about us. We are an important part of their program in a negative sense. For we are regarded as obstacles to their ends being reached. They think a lot about us. They worry, particularly about our young people coming to meetings and listening to people, their parents, churches, telling them about creation, whatever it might be. They talk about churches on the internet, and they even hold camps that try to offer an alternative to young people to those sorts of camps that we've held during the summer. So we perhaps ought to try to get the bare bones, at least, of what these people are about. Politics and government is, after all, now coming very much to the fore, with the state very much part of the problem that we as Christians are facing. The passing of laws and the creating of policies are having an enormous impact on us. How then has this come about? What has gone before us? So as I develop that this evening, we perhaps may be a little surprised at some of the things that have shaped today's movers and shakers. So let us proceed. And my next heading is this: From Russia Without Love. From Russia Without Love. Part of the story of what has shaped us to be the country we are today is something that we will call cultural Marxism. Cultural Marxism. We're perhaps familiar with the dictum of Karl Marx, the radical 19th century thinker, that religion is the opiate of the people. To his mind, it helped stifle the revolutionary consciousness of oppressed workers, whose interests would be better served by casting off the shackles of capitalism and seizing power. Religion, he felt, was a fiction that kept workers away from their true destiny and was a convenient ploy used by the ruling classes to keep workers in a state of economic and social subjection. So it needed to go. But implementing these ideas proved to be a little more difficult. We'd perhaps be quite familiar with the unsuccessful efforts of the Soviet Union to eradicate religion, especially Christianity. We're also perhaps familiar with the efforts of Chairman Mao in the Chinese Cultural Revolution to remove religion, again unsuccessfully, from national life. Now we're just as familiar with hearing about the great strides forward that the church is making, at least in some parts of China. We pray still for progress in North Korea, one of the last bastions of the Marxist experiment, still holding out against change, and where the church is still facing horrendous persecution. What we may not know is that there were radical Marxist thinkers who looked on in horror at the failure of the Soviet model and deplored the grotesque abuse of power by the state. They wondered what could be done. How could it be done better in the future? To their way of thinking, the problem was that the workers had not been able to see the need for them to seize their moment. The state, as embodied in the party, was meant to be a caretaker until the working class reached sufficient maturity to take over from them. But instead,
The state remained in power, supposedly holding the reins of government until the working class came of age, but actually serving its own foul purposes. A different and more subtle tack was needed that did not require revolution and the overthrow of the ruling or governing class. More gradual change was needed to acclimatise the workers to the idea of radical solutions, so that they could mature and eventually reach the age of their political majority. This approach has come to be known as cultural Marxism. It promised that radical change could be achieved by a slow process of changing culture. When people had got used to thinking differently about various moral issues, for example, they would then be ready for revolutionary economic solutions. Cultural Marxism was associated especially with a Marxist from Italy called Antonio Gramsci. He courted the displeasure of the Italian dictator Benito Mussolini and spent a fair part of his life in prison. This gave him time to think and write down some of his thoughts, his so-called prison notebooks. He identified some of the vital institutions to be moved out of the way if new ways of thinking were to become the norm and the rather dormant working class awakened to lay hold of its true destiny. These roadblocks to change included the church and the family. Surprise, surprise. These both, to his mind, were conservative forces transmitting values that held up the implementation of the revolution. They were key places where a careful and covert battle needed to be fought to dismantle their power. One way he identified to help the immature working class get used to radical economic ideas was to champion various marginal and non-orthodox groups whose morality and ways of thinking were not conventional by the views of the ruling class, the dominant culture of the day. If people could be acclimatized to think differently about what was right and what was wrong, if they could be exposed to these unconventional groups, then the working class, and everybody to that matter, could be detached from their traditional moral moorings and be made more sympathetic to new thoughts, such as a revolution. In other words, it would be a subtle culture war. These kinds of ideas were already in measure in circulation in the United Kingdom through the Fabian Society, which had some supporters mildly sympathetic to the Soviet Union and hopeful of social change. Their maxim was taken from the Roman politician and general Fabius Maximus, whose victories were gained through stealth, cunning, and attritional warfare versus full frontal attack. There were considerable overlaps between the Fabians and such groups as the Bohemian Bloomsbury set, with their very unconventional views about relationships and who you could fall in love with, and about which we might say more later on. Ian Murray has written a very interesting short book about some of the important British writers like Thomas Hardy, who in the 19th century were already feeling their way towards this new kind of moral thinking. All this chimed in with those who would call themselves atheists and who chafed against Christian morality. They advocated the so-called findings of Sigmund Freud, a hugely influential thinker and practitioner, and his claims that Christian morality stood in the way of a healthy mental life. This, amongst other things, provided intellectual ballast for some of these people at least. The failure, then, of the Soviet experiment left a generation of younger radical intellectuals open to the ideas of people like Gramsci. These ideas were in circulation among Communist Party people of the 1960s and 1970s. The rise of feminism, which formed the central plank of the 1960s sexual revolution and the permissive society, was attractive to these political radicals, because here was a different form of morality, to which many of them subscribed anyway, and which had potential to challenge the existing order. Here was a way to bring about cultural change, to demolish the restraint of the traditional family with its power to shape the thinking of the young, especially through the headship of the father, and a way to challenge the morality taught by the church. When the Gay Liberation Front started in 1970 in the United Kingdom with its agenda for change, this too was recognised as a good way to advance radical change. These feminist and radical movements with different ideas about love were thus seen for their radical revolutionary potential, having a sufficient challenge to the established order to merit the support of the more Marxist dreamers. Peter Tatchell, the gay activist and campaigner, made clear the existence of this coalition, writing in the Guardian newspaper on August the 6th of this year. He tells us about his early years as an activist with the Gay Liberation Front, the forerunner of organisations like Stonewall. Looking back at the GLF manifesto published in London in 1971, he tells us that it went further than simply seeking to get recognition and approval for homosexual behaviour and acts. Instead, he tells us that the manifesto led him into new ways of thinking. I quote him. "It was an eye-opener, expanding my civil rights perspective into a more radical critique of heterosexism, male privilege, and the tyranny of traditional gender roles. It woke me up to the fact that queer liberation involved much both social and personal change, that we could, within the bounds of existing society, create an alternative culture that would liberate everyone regardless of gender, sexuality, or gender identity." Well, we get the idea of the direction of travel there, don't we? We're moving well away from what the Bible approves of. This is a revolution of massive proportions that is being aimed at the church and against traditional morality. Peter Tatchell tells us more. "This manifesto," he says, "articulates a radical agenda for a non-violent revolution in cultural values and social institutions. It critiques homophobia, sexism, marriage, the nuclear family, monogamy, the cults of youth and beauty, patriarchy, the gay ghetto, and rigid male and female gender roles. As well as opposing the way things are, it outlines an alternate vision, including living communally, gender-subversive, radical, drag and non-possessive, multi-partner open relationships. The message was innovate, don't assimilate." That was back in the early 1970s. We may agree with him on the critique of the cult of youth and beauty, but not with much else. The family, male headship, proper sexual relationships, marriage, all of it was out in the brave new world that these people wanted back in 1971. And we have to say that, largely speaking, from our vantage point of 2013, they have succeeded. The pressure of the feminist critique of society was, of course, already being keenly felt in governing circles, where such things as the right to abortion, state-sponsored contraception, and avant-garde sex education had become established as rights, and that as far back as the 1960s. The process of change was already underway. The pop culture and the permissiveness that was becoming fashionable had its own revolutionary dynamic that made its political case for change and the relaxation of laws. So here is an interesting thing. Far from being dour intellectuals, many of the radical political idealists were themselves libertines and were fully cashing in on the sexual revolution. In other words, they did what they liked. They just followed the way of pleasure and did not have much regard for moral rules. Their atheism, those who were atheists, gave them intellectual leave to follow a libertarian line. No God, no moral code, no judgment, no worries. Do what you like. Broadcasting, writing, academia, education, and government itself, key areas in either hindering or promoting the progress of radical ideas, these were key areas for those who were politically inclined looking to seize them and to turn them round to their own agenda. This process of gradually changing the culture through making compliant the parts that oppose radical ideas has been termed the long march through the institutions. The long march through the institutions. This took the idea of Chairman Mao's long march with his workers in China, but now made it into something to do with ideas. Those with these high ideals had to patiently get their ideas embedded into the way we think by chipping away at all those restraints we were looking at a few weeks back. A long march, indeed. Law, education, broadcasting, family, church and government. These institutions were the targets for this cultural revolution. There was to be the gradual overturning of the old order through the championing of these oppressed groups. If the workers cottoned on to this, well and good. If not, too bad. The newly identified oppressed groups had a case worth supporting on its own merits. The central part that their sexual or racial identity was playing in the shaping of politics led to the term identity politics being coined in honour of it. And now my next heading, nearer to home. Nearer to home. Well, we have to concede, whatever we may or may not think about trade unions, many good things they do there in protecting workers, we're sure, but one of the earliest champions of these radical ideas were the trade unions. Many of, it has to be conceded, their influential members were communists, supporters of gay rights and feminist agendas. To these issues were also added minorities whose religion and practice was contra the perceived prevailing culture of Christianity. Of course, not everything that was espoused we'd recognise as wrong. Racism was a scar on our national conscience and still is to a large extent, perhaps. Equal pay and equal conditions for women in the workplace seem reasonable and good aims, and the end of sexual harassment is surely a worthy goal. Except, of course, it did not end there. Here is another bit of terminology to give us a bit of indigestion tonight. Here we are, getting our cultural Marxism books out here, whatever. Feminism had its first wave with Emily Pankhurst and the move to have a vote given to women. Second wave feminism was just as we've described, securing equal conditions in the workplace. But third wave feminism was looking to do a thorough critique of society, especially patriarchy, with a view to ordering family structure differently, freeing women from the perceived drudgery of having children and remaining chained to the home. The unions, it has to be said, and their upper echelons were well staffed with people with these views. By now, we might also add, these third wave feminist thinkers are found in Bible colleges, bringing their radical ideas to bear upon the interpretation of the Bible. Besides the unions, one of the earliest testbeds for these identity politics was local government in the 1980s. The hard-left militant authorities, and kindly and dismissively called the loony left by their detractors, sought to implement their pro-feminism, pro-gay, pro-minorities agenda. They were backed by the radical unions, whose power over the erstwhile Labour Party was considerable through their so-called block votes that they could exercise at the Labour conference. They had a large percentage of the votes that could be cast, and they could vote for policies of their choice. In 1985, they actually overturned the way that the main executive wanted them to vote, and in the card vote were able to introduce their pro-gay policies into Labour official policy. Also, the funding they gave to the Labour Party, which with the memberships they then boasted, was a huge chunk of the Labour Party's income, meant again that they could move forward a radical agenda. Neil Kinnock, then party leader, famously denounced the militant wing of Liverpool City Council at the 1985 Labour Party conference. A year later, the radical Greater London Council also came to an end, courtesy of Mrs. Thatcher. So, when in addition the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, we might have thought that this brought an end to this cultural Marxism and revolution through championing oppressed groups. Right? Wrong. The ideas now lived on amongst the ranks of the newly created New Labour. Their numbers boasted a considerable company of ex-Communist Party members and atheists. The attack on traditional Christian values in the family, in schools, has been carried on apace, but now from within the heart of government, rather than simply through identity politics-type pressure groups or fringe political movements. They were respectable-looking, but often had a pedigree that owed something at least to Gramsci. Their political teeth cut, sometimes in radical student politics or radical union activity. What we call the progressive agenda has become embedded in the day-to-day practice of the ruling political power. From the government itself, we could now expect stout defence against any threat to past gains made in abortion rights and sex education. There was, for example, the implementation of pro-gay policies such as civil partnerships, the removal of Section 28 in schools, which outlawed teaching about relationships other than marriage, and a place at the table for Stonewall, the militant campaigning group for alternative relations. Interesting too, isn't it? Just in this last week, and all this business about Ed Miliband and his father, Ralph Miliband. In fact, it struck me a few years back then, Roger did a bit of rooting around for me on the internet to find out the influence that his father had had upon his thinking, Ed Miliband, that is. The Daily Mail's had its crack at that, but I'm sure there in Ralph Miliband's past he was a Marxist, he was against Stalin and against some of the developments there that had happened in Russia, but was all for changes in society and wanted a considerably reordered society than what we have now. And how much of that agenda, at least in terms of its willingness to move morality in a different direction, at least his son Ed has inherited, well, maybe time will tell. But it's an interesting question that relates to this whole issue, really, ultimately, of cultural Marxism. Now, this is not meant to single out New Labour for particular criticism. It is, however, because they have been the political movement that has achieved power in the past and been most influential in bringing difficulty for Christians and Christian morality in our age. They were the people who brought in the legislation that has left us with the legacy that we now have. They've also succeeded in changing the political landscape so that everyone who follows them now has to accept the changes that they made as givens. It is as if all who follow are unable to undo what they have done. Even if the majority of people in the country may not be wildly enthusiastic about what they have done, the culture that politicians respond to and are ruled by accepts this new morality as good and desirable. But I briefly now just want to look at other movements that have also been at work in our culture, and which also have no objection to what has taken place. So my next heading is this: a quick look at the libertarians. A quick look at the libertarians. Recently, of course, we've had the moves to have homosexual marriage legislated for. This, however, has not come from those on what we call the political left, but from those in the coalition government, something perhaps we might say more to the right. But wonder not at it. Yes, New Labour succeeded in shifting the political consensus so that no party feels comfortable challenging the new morality. But the coalition government is peopled by those who have in themselves little sympathy with the Christian worldview. They will allow for what people want to do, as long as it does no harm to anyone else. For example, coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, have long supported more liberal views on sexuality and have quite a few in their ranks who would claim to be atheists, including their present leader, Nick Clegg. The Conservatives have a considerable quantity of libertarians, or social liberals, among whom we might mention the present Mayor of London, Boris Johnson, as well as our Prime Minister, Mr. David Cameron. Their own sexual mores are not especially always in sympathy with Christian morality. Likewise, it's younger elements who are part of the Eton inner cabal that are actually governing are people of the generation for whom pop culture and the sexual revolution are things to be taken for granted.
They are more relaxed about looser sexual practices. They've not got much fight when it comes to the defence of Christian truth or values. Who knows what they got up to in the Bullingdon Club and as its ilk there rampage through the city of dreaming spires and elsewhere. They feel their prospects of holding on to power long-term lie with following the developing progressive culture of the young. Gay marriage has become an attractive policy to pursue with longer-term political gains, so they hope. The long march through the institutions is running its course. The political philosophy of cultural Marxism has worked with a host of other counter-Christian trends to leave us in the marginalised place we are in today. They've left our younger generation apathetic towards the views of the church, the law of God, and the fear of God. Young people all have gay friends. Many of them live with their partners. Sex before marriage is regarded as a relic of a bygone age. They all have divorced parents, so what is the fuss about marriage anyway? Recreational sex is the norm. Drug use is okay. Sunday is like any other day, or certainly not a day to go and worship God. Who is the Lord that they should fear him? My next heading, plus the new atheists. Plus the new atheists. We must also quickly mention the rise of the new atheism as a contemporary driver of culture. Most of their work has already been done for them. It is to be suspected that without these vocal writers and spokesmen for atheism, that the statistics would still show remarkable apathy about worship and the things of God. But the new atheists have hastened the process. The popularizing of their virulent and confident attacks against the Bible and the God of the Bible may not have swollen the numbers of rooting-tooting atheists, but it has helped add to skepticism about the claims of the evangelical church and especially of creationists. Their stock is high among the young and the not-so-young, spurred on by the damaging impact of 9/11, which propelled forward the thought that religion is dangerous and kills people. They've given great stimulus to secularism, which demands the removal of all privileging of religion, especially Christianity, from public life. Atheists are found among the writers, broadcasters, in government, local councils, comedians. They're all part of the culture war, giving expression to the rebellion of the human heart over and against the restraints placed there by God in his mercy. Their books and programs help firm people up in their scepticism and immorality. Those who have taken up the cause of the long march through the institutions do so today with lighter step. Libertarians advocate their causes with slightly greater gusto. Writers pursue their home brand atheism with a sense of greater intellectual weight behind their views. New atheists are maybe not the most important part of the process of cultural change that is all around us, but in their own way, they're helping to change the way we think, what we regard as acceptable. They are influencing wider culture to embrace rebellion against God, adjusting the worldview to eliminate the God who supernaturally made the heavens and the earth, making the thought offensive that there can be but one way to be acceptable to God. It's interesting to see how often there is an overlap between pro-abortion, pro-homosexuality, pro-feminism, atheism, and the general progressive agenda. Cultural Marxism has come of age, as have other political and social agendas. Forget the workers now. The revolution against the church, Christians, and God himself has come. Welcome to Britain 2013. So some thoughts as we finish. This has been maybe a lengthy consideration. There's much more we could say. So let's finish on a practical note. What are some of the preliminary conclusions we can draw? Firstly, do not give up. None of this is any reason whatsoever to lapse into despair. Such an attitude would not be worthy of Christian men and women in any case. Recognition, however, of where we are and what's been shaping our culture is an aid to our prayers. It also gives us a lead as to how to conduct our evangelism. We'll look at that in weeks to come. There are plenty of opportunities in Godless Britain 2013, and we should seize them.
Secondly, we do well, I think, to watch political developments more closely. Politics, as I mentioned earlier, has been something we've wanted to stay out of. It wants to be too tightly bound to any political party or position. But it is as well to reflect upon trends in political thinking. These things are more likely than ever before to have a bearing upon the church. What are the ideas that are shaping the views of upcoming political leaders today? Whose books are they reading? What have been their formative influences? Where is the balance between restraint and total depravity in their philosophy? For religion is now a highly politicized idea. If we're going to communicate with these people, it is as well to know what is in their thinking, at least to some extent. Thirdly, we are the church militant. We have a mandate from the Lord. He is with his people. Psalm 124 tells us this: "If it had not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, if it had not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us alive when their wrath was kindled against us." We are told that our help is in the name of the Lord. Nothing of what has been said should daunt us. None of this is reason to extrapolate ahead and predict our doom. We'll see later on as we consider what our response actually should be to this situation. But note that we are still here. The Lord has been on our side, and here we are to this very day. The Lord has not given us up. We're still standing, and by the will of God, we'll remain standing until the Lord returns. The Lord is with his people. There is still evidence of the special favor of the Lord who moves the hearts and minds of unbelievers to help the Lord's people. We still, on occasion at least, see some of the votes going in our favor. So we recall that we, in this present godless age, have a calling to remain faithful to our God and to live there as salt and light, even though there is a lot of darkness that is surrounding us at present time.